This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri, and Sunu Chandy is here. She is a civil rights lawyer. She's an LGBTQ activist, and she has a new book. Give us a poem, Sunu.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Grace. My new book is called My Dear Comrades. It comes out March 28. And I'm actually starting with a poem called 95. My spouse and I were caregivers of her late grandmother, and it's only been less than a month since she passed away. And this was a poem written about her. So it's dedicated to Elaine Osborne in loving memory and to all the caregivers out there. 95. When I asked my Facebook friends, who mostly don't know her, to send cards for her 95th, I hesitate to write, and she will open them on her birthday. But I write it anyway. My partner confides that when Granny is reaching a big birthday, she just hopes that she'll make it. And in writing this poem, I feel afraid to put these words down onto paper too. Last week, Granny said, any kind of cake would be just fine, as long as it comes with a trip home to Barbados. And while there's no trip to Barbados this year, it was the middle of the pandemic, the carrots are ready to be grated into her cake, the packages of cream cheese ready to be whipped into homemade frosting. We will all take Wednesday off, finding some place that is outdoors and away from all the people. We're wondering if she'll keep her mask on her face. I'm wondering what color she will select for her home pedicure. I'm wondering if she will say, I thank you very much, when I am done with her fingers and her toes. I know one day I will miss her singing random lines of hymns that ring through our apartment. He taught me how to watch and pray and live rejoicing every day, happy day, happy day, when Jesus washed my sins away. I won't miss dragging up the large boxes of her necessary supplies from the lobby every few weeks, or the days when we have strangers in our home as substitute health aides. I will miss asking our daughter to take Great Granny some portion of anything we cook at home, even if she's already eaten. I won't miss always sitting in the back seat for every family trip, but I'll miss her laugh. I'll miss when we poke gentle fun at my spouse, her granddaughter. I will miss us playfully teasing our daughter, her great granddaughter. Back during our third non-date date in August 2008, my now spouse said, come, let me take you by the house. I sat quietly on the couch as far away as I could from her roommate, Granny, this elder who had lost her only daughter just 1 year before and was now stuck with her youngest granddaughter. This elder who had to start relying on this 27-year-old kid to make all her salads, complete her paperwork, take her to all her medical appointments. This kid who hadn't lived at home for years, who was used to leaving town at a moment's notice with a medium backpack. And now this kid needed a vehicle and one big enough to carry it all. Not just any trunk, one large enough to accommodate the walker, the suitcases, the wheelchair, the pull-ups. And now, 12 years later, even though Granny sometimes asks, why are those two men kissing, when Modern Family comes on the television, she also refers to me, her granddaughter's wife, as her own beloved grandkid, too.
Sunu Chandy, there is so much compassion in every poem in this book. What is the title of the book? And what do you think you've told readers with these poems? What's it about?
This book is called My Dear Comrades, and this book is about building community. It's about the everyday decisions we make about which side we're on. We know we have so many fights going on in our society today and so many ways that we can show up for one another. And this book is about how we can do that, and how we can make amends when we don't, and be empathetic to each other through it all.
So well said. You know, I felt you have a very dynamic life, a very dramatic life, I think. But the poems in this book are about your children, about law school, your daughter, you're about law school. It's a book about my feelings. It is so accessible and so much in common with every woman, I think, that it's going to make us less lonely when we read it. Give us two poems from this new book, Dear Comrade.
So this is a poem that I wanted to share because of all the attacks on LGBTQ young people, whether it's about transgender kids and healthcare, or it's about what's happening in our schools. There's so many places where we are going backwards and these fights are continuing. And I wanted to reach back and share a poem that was really about someone who was important to me when I was going through some of those questions. And it's about Urvashi Vaad. Who's Urvashi? It was a season of low-key thinking my life was over because of my weird crush on L. Could not in any way imagine my life moving forward in that lane. Carefully told one friend, but assured her this whole thing had to be on the back burner. And then that summer after the first year of college at our Chicagoland social justice internships, my new work best friend, Richard Sandman, casually asked if I wanted to go hear Urvashi Vaad speak. Who's Urvashi? Who's Urvashi? Yeah, who's Urvashi? It was akin to someone throwing me a life jacket, even before I realized without one, I certainly would have drowned. It was a life jacket that meant my life was possible. Others have done this before. Others with families from India have done this before. Others in India have done this. I certainly fell out of my chair that summer afternoon, the window to our beloved Lake Michigan and Richard, my only witnesses. I must have sat there with my mouth wide open, equally with shock and delight. And every time now when I worry about being out in this world, I remember those two college interns in the summer of 1991, sharing the kind of information so crucial to building our lives. Yeah, and that's about Urvashi Vaad, a really important LGBTQ activist who passed away last year. Yeah. And she also went to Northeastern Law School. She was the head of the National LGBTQ Task Force and had many leadership roles as an Indian American woman. And it was so important to know about her when I was in college.
Well, before you read your next poem, I want them to know about you. Yeah. And that they can see that you've been published in many poem publications, Asian American Literary Review, Beltway, Poets on Adoption, Split This Rock, The Quarry, in anthologies, The Penguin Book of Indian Poets, and much, much more. Now let's have another poem.
Great, great. So another one of the sort of issues in society, and you know, my colleagues at the National Women's Law Center work on a range of these issues of gender justice, but there is a moment where religion is being used as a sword to harm people. And I think most of us understand that religion can really be a force for justice and for love. And so as the daughter of a minister and coming from a very religious Christian family based in Kerala, South India, I wanted to read this newer poem. It's called, Who is this man that the wind and the waves obey him? This was the only man allowed on the walls of our childhood home. No making idols of Michael Jackson, no Kenny Rogers, no Billy Joel, no Barry Manilow, no Bryan Adams, only Jesus. No other man on our t-shirts either. No Chicago Bulls players, no Chicago Bears, no Red Sox, no Cubs, only Jesus. No Sunday sleeping in, no lazy boozy brunches, no laundry before it gets crowded, no boat ride on Lake Michigan, only morning worship at the house of the Lord. No house on the prairie, no Knight Rider, no Wonder Woman, not when it's time for family prayer in the evening, only Jesus. Who is this man that says turn the other cheek, that says turn the tables upside down, that says be kind to the sex worker, that says, stop for the man who falls down on the side of the road, no matter his tribe. The man who says, love your neighbor and for sure take the speck out of your own eye first. This man, This man who says love, 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 love. This man, his name is Jesus.
You know, I know a lot of lawyers who are writers, and there's one thing I believe that I see all of you have in common. Most of the poems are very clear and accessible. Do you think that your writing for the law assists that, or do you think it doesn't have anything to do with it? Is poetry an opposite from law? Are they two separate rooms in the house, or do they intersect? How does that writing work?
That is a very good question. I think poems and legal briefs can be super obtuse. And I think in both of these arenas, I try very hard to be clear. And sometimes people think if the writing is clear, it's not interesting. And I hope that we are beyond that now. I don't think you need fancy words in law or in poetry to make your point. So in that way, I see some parallels. My legal writing, I try to be very direct. I try to use short sentences. I try to make my point. I also love language, right? I see that you have some translations in your work. You know, I did my MFA at Queen's College, and there is a focus on literary translation. So I love the use of language. I loved taking the craft of translation where we had group projects and we had to figure out which word is the right word to use when we are translating a poem. And I loved that. And if you see at the end of my book, I talk about translating the title, My Dear Comrades, to Malayalam, the language of Kerala, India, and all the many words that can stand in for friendship, kinship, family, and had a wonderful WhatsApp back and forth with my cousin. So I love words, I love language, but I also think the poetry is a part of my identity as a social justice activist. And there may be a few poems in the book that are hard to understand or you're not really sure what it's about, but most of them are pretty clear and accessible.
I attest to that. I will tell you it's true. And let's prove it to them by hearing two together.
All
Sue
right.
Chandy.
Thank you. This is a new poem. And as I mentioned, I'm at the National Women's Law Center for my day job. My colleagues are working day and night on abortion rights, along with everything else, given what has happened with our Supreme Court. And so many people in our country are suffering medically, legally, in all these different ways because of the change in our laws. And we're all fighting back on that. And this is a poem that is a newer piece that I felt driven to write after what's happened in our courts. It's called Miscarriage Management. After the longed-for message on the answering machine about the good cells multiplying, one afternoon the doctor announced he could not locate a heartbeat. He said I would need a DNC before trying again. It was in the days immediately following Maithili's wedding, where I had read a poem to the gathered family, just as the fetus cells were leaving my body in the form of heavy bleeding. No one knew why I ran away right after the ceremony and took a bus to the taxi to the subway, getting all the way from the suburbs of Philadelphia back to Fort Greene, Brooklyn. The next day, the doctor said, bleeding doesn't always mean miscarriage. On the third day, he told me to go across the street to some other office for the D&C procedure. I called a few friends to ask if someone could accompany me the next day as required. Shalini took all her work meetings from the waiting room on that day. And I did not have to justify to anyone why I needed a DNC. I did not have to fear arrest on top of my heartbreak. I had the protections of Roe. I had the protections of the US Constitution. It did not depend on my state of residence. It did not depend on my attorney general. I did not have to prove I was raped. I did not have to prove my life was in danger. I did not have to say the word incest. I did not have to be 10 years old. I only needed to follow my doctor's instructions and tend to my once again broken heart. I only needed to say a hopeful prayer for the fifth and last IVF procedure. I only needed to find one friend, someone who could come with me, someone who could see me home.
We know you are the legal director for the National Women's Law Center, and now we know that that director has a huge heart. And let us hear another poem.
Thank you. Well, there's no lack of social justice issues for us to take on in our legal work, in our poetry, in our art. And the next poem is a newer one, and it's about gun safety. I want to thank all the activists, children, families, parents who are working hard to end gun violence. Every Town for Gun Safety is one such organization, and I hope that we can support their work. This poem is called My Daughter Now Dreams of Guns. My daughter now dreams of guns, shot in some random building. Teachers are there, but she's not at school. She's behind a wall and safe, but sees someone she doesn't know, shooting someone else. She says the school IT person was there with her, and her social studies teacher too. Once, when her school had a bomb scare involving a former student, the police came. They assured everyone that they met with the family involved. My daughter reassures me the former student doesn't live in the area anymore. My daughter says she feels okay, since it wasn't a current student, and this time there wasn't a gun.
And another, Sunu Chandy.
Thank you. Well, I think this is the one that you had suggested that I read. This is entitled Jerusalem. This is both about, goodness, the ongoing struggle in the Middle East, and also about just being a foreign exchange student during college, as some of the listeners might have been, and how those dynamics work together. I thought it was interesting that in one of the reviews of my book, that someone pulled out that I was for all the marginalized groups and said, particularly Palestinians, was so fascinating since I named so many groups in this book. But I guess I took from that, if you name Palestine, then you are an advocate for Palestinians, which is there's a lot to unpack there. So this poem is called Jerusalem. Morning mint tea with Mohammed and then shopping in the market. Today for ceramic blue tiles and an olive wood nativity set. I weave between tourists on the Holy Land Jesus Way of the Cross tours. Someone was stabbed right here yesterday. Cries were heard two streets over at our Gloria Hotel. I touch the stone where Jesus had once lay, light a candle and pay my donation. I place yet another prayer in the Wailing Wall. This time, that no one else be sexually assaulted ever again, inshallah. Our classmate's body was grabbed on the first night. She still shivers when she talks about that evening. Last week's prayers, the classmate who vomits at the hotel after dinner every night. We tour refugee camps with starving children and then harvest lush green olives. After floating in the Dead Sea, we create our own mud mask facials. My handsome friend organizes his own belated bar mitzvah. After a day picking kiwis, we gather in the kibbutz basement bomb shelter. Katusha rockets are coming in tonight from southern Lebanon. The skinniest white girl on the program tells me daily how fat she is. We are roommates and I am twice her size. The Mexican-American girl keeps being mistreated, mistaken for Arab. She buys herself flowers to distract. Mid-semester break, we escape to Cairo and Alexandria, to pyramids and beaches. Back in Jerusalem, we stood vigil with the women in black, meet gay activists, attend a Palestinian secret radical meeting, location undisclosed. Just show up here and they'll take you. Later that evening, dinner with the Indian Jewish Women's Organization. The next day, riding through Gaza, We get caught between Palestinian children with rocks and Israeli tanks. Crouched between the bus seats, we witness defiant Palestinian women run towards Israeli tanks. Anger and stones, their only weapons. Less than an hour later, we are lounging, drinking with the UN soldiers at the beach club in Gaza. Rested up, we happily returned to Jerusalem. We had missed our favorite falafel stand, the bakery with the best challah bread, and the Jerusalem Dance Club, where the entryway sign read, "No dogs and no Arabs."
Sunu is a graduate of Northeastern Law School and Earlham College, where she majored in women's studies and peace and global studies, as we can tell. Sunu also has an MFA in poetry, as we can also tell. You know, that you do so many things. You are on the board of the Transgender Law Center. Where is that located?
They're a national organization and they have offices all over, and some of the folks are in California as well.
Yeah. And what does that center provide for people?
So there's advocacy alongside local organizations, especially with all of the attacks on trans folks. They're supporting grassroots organizing, and there's also legal help. So there's a helpline. So if you look at the Transgender Law Center website, there's ways to connect people, whether it's about healthcare, you know, harassment in schools or family support. There's a lot of advocacy, both through government agencies and through courts, but also with individuals.
Have you ever had to argue a case, or is that not your role?
No, actually, at the National Women's Law Center, I'm the legal director. And so we bring lots of amicus briefs in court where we talk about the common seed of discrimination, whether it be against cisgender women or trans women. The discrimination and harassment is of one cloth. And the Supreme Court actually acknowledged that in a recent case a few years ago named Bostock, that all of these laws that protect against sex discrimination protect LGBTQ people too in the workplace. And so we are making sure that that's clear in a range of other settings too.
Do you have courage because you have such strong belief and passion for your cause? Does that give you courage to be in a courtroom, for example, where it's rather, it calls upon a certain amount of strength? Do you believe your beliefs give you the strength?
I think my friends and having good company and having the resources and the privileges. I mean, thinking about that poem that I have about the LSAT, which is just really one symbol of the larger picture. And we have all these attacks on affirmative action and this myth that we all have the same resources and abilities in terms of access, which is just not true. And so I think that whatever courage I have is a testament to my parents who were immigrants to this country, to people like Irva Shivad and other activists who came before who really put themselves out there. And I'm definitely on the shoulders of and in the footsteps of so many people who've come before. And I think I'm doing my best to sort of provide that to the younger folks as well.
Well, we're so glad to meet you. Let's hear a poem.
Sure.
Title of the book again is Dear Comrades.
My Dear Comrades. And I have just a couple more poems. So this one again is a new one. And it's about, I was just hearing on the news recently these altercations in airplanes, and it's so scary. And this was also a setting in an airplane. Last warning to the man in seat 18D. After asking the flight attendant for hot tea and the, "It'll be a while, honey, before we get to any hot drinks," the answer to "what the heck do I do now" arrived clear as day. Instead of just wondering if the man in seat 18D was racist, I will whack him. Whack him with the Black woman's leather jacket, and then maybe I would ask him what he did and why he did it. While whacking him, I would say, "How dare you hijack my flight? So now I have to spend it wondering all the ways your actions might or might not be racist. And how maybe you're related to this white lady and wanted to sit next to her instead of this Black lady. But it's so obvious you don't even know the white woman. So then why did you take my seat? So now I have to sit and consider all the reasons why. It seems to me you need a segregationist sin blinking light over your damn row. And after 7 whacks for causing me that trouble, I might give you a chance to explain. You might say, what's the big deal? And why do they assign seats AC and then DF? But if you knew you were in the wrong seat before I arrived, why didn't you just move into your back into your own seat? And if it wasn't because of the dark-skinned Black woman in 18A, then what was it? You want to play seat segregation with me on the flight to Birmingham? Letters from a Birmingham jail, Birmingham, 4 little Black girls killed in the church bombing, Birmingham, dogs and fire hoses set on peaceful Black protesters, Birmingham. Don't fuck with me on the way to Birmingham. What? What, you heard I was a pacifist? Really? Well, this is the airplane racism exception. You never heard of that? You try being stuck above the gray clouds and the sunny sunshine, and instead having to wonder if the man sitting next to you for 2 whole hours, with only this little aisle between us, took your assigned seat in the name of anti-Blackness. Don't let it happen again. Sweetie, wake up. Wake up. Here's your hot tea.
You have received many honors. And in 2021, I think you were one of most significant queer women in Washington, D.C. And that was a great honorific. Was it from Mayor Bowser or was it from the Blade newspaper?
I think it was a team. I don't think I actually heard who made the decision, but it was announced to me, and I think it was during the pandemic. So I think they had it in the newspaper, and that was the main way that we celebrated.
And how do you like being one of the significant women? How do they choose you, I wonder?
I have no, this is one of those things where you just wonder, well, who nominated me and why? And you're just sort of told. And I appreciate being able to shed light on my work at Transgender Law Center and National Women's Law Center and Split This Rock. I think at that time I might have been a board member, and just being able to really bring celebration to these communities that I'm a part of. So I think that that's the most exciting part about getting these.
Yes, honors. What you represent. And I think I met you first from a poem on Split This Rock online. So that poetry preceded you. And I've been sort of watching you from a distance for a very long time. From India, your parents from India. And what do you think are your main characteristics still from lineage?
Oh, goodness. I think there are some positive things and some things that are more challenging. I think that I love that the title of my book, My Dear Comrades, is very community-based. Mm-hmm. And I think definitely from my family, extended family, there's a sense of we're all in this together and we're here to support each other. I think the downside of that is sometimes there is a sense of if you step out even slightly from expectations, then you're bringing shame on this whole community because we're all part of the same sort of thing. And so I think many of us as kids of immigrants have been trying to hang on to the good, hang on to the love and the community, but also letting ourselves and our children be who they are and be themselves. And I think that is the struggle of our generation.
Well, I had an argument with some philosophy students yesterday about what culture is, which is a very vague word. What do you think culture is? Is it a sense? Is it our sense of common language? Is it taste? Is it beliefs? It is a very hard word to pin down. Do you think that coming from India, that you're part of a culture, even though you're an American, but sure. the lineage, what is that culture?
You know what I found interesting? I was able to live in India between college and law school for 10 months. And what I found really fascinating is all the subcultures. So even at that time, so many years ago, you know, there was like Benetton and Hard Rock and all of these sort of super quote unquote American and Western places in the cities in India, even in South India and Bangalore and other places. And it seemed to me one of the real keys to this was the city culture versus the rural villages. And so at the same time, many, many subcultures are going on. And so it's very hard to say in this country, this is how it is. Think about the US, right? We have the same thing. We have the coast, we have rural areas, we have the Midwest. And so I grew up in the Midwest for many years. My family's still in Chicago. And so, but I've also lived in Boston. I lived in New York for 15 years. I've lived in DC. So all of these pieces are subcultures that are coexisting, right?
Yeah.
The other thing I think about with culture is culture change, which is the work that we're all in. And if we can't rely on the courts, we have to rely on telling our stories to each other and making sure that we are bringing one another along through these individual relationships so that we can change culture so that it includes more of us.
And that is what your book does. So give us a final poem.
Sure. If we have time, I have two short ones.
We'll do it.
Okay, great. So the next one is really dedicated to my mom, Mary Chandy. And it's about, as I said, my parents were religious faith leaders and they were always at church meetings. And this was like the one highlight for me in relation to that. Hmm. Picking up Linzer Tort cookies for the Quaker potluck. Mom would come home from church receptions with one cookie wrapped in a napkin in her purse only for me. Last night, for the first time, I tried this trick too. It's not that we couldn't stop and buy you an entire box of cookies on any given day. It's that we don't. And in 30 years, you may imagine me standing among the grown-ups and the chatter of superstorms, job losses, and preschools, thinking instead for a moment of you. You and the dance you would do when handed one shortbread cookie with a cutout heart of shining red raspberry jam. You and the dance you would do, hands in the air, hips swaying. Thank you, Amma. Thank you, Amma. As you bit into the delight of a childhood Tuesday evening, stopping only to search my face to decipher whether I came home with anything more. Thank you. And the last poem that I'd like to share today is from a prompt. And I wanted to name that because so many of my poems are from prompts. And six of them were from Leila Chatti's Praise in Hard Times virtual class with the Provincetown Fine Arts Center that was during the pandemic. So really want to give them a shout out. This last poem is a newer one, and it was a prompt from Jen Soriano just last month in January. Jen is a friend I met through Unicorn Authors, an online community, and she is the author of forthcoming book, Nervous, Essays on Heritage and Healing from Amistad HarperCollins. I'm really excited to read her book again and give her a blurb this month. So she's been on my mind. And her prompt was, if you had to paint a picture of gentleness, it would feel like. The title of this poem is Crystal with Her Hand in the Air. Crystal with her hand in the air to get our attention, not a sound, not a word. Ajoy Auntie saying, I understand if you can't make it. Those email tags that say, if this is not a day you are working, please don't worry about responding until you are on duty again. Thich Nhat Hanh, the day after 9/11, with the nuns at the beach. We understand if you need to come late. I saved you a seat. I saved you a plate. I saved you a book. I saved you a drink. I saved you a cookie. I saved you half my sandwich. Actually, you can wear what you want to his church. You can wear what you want to their house. You can wear what you want to her party. It's a come as you are wedding. You can dress up if you want. Suggested attire, come as you like. From now on, only soft pants, yoga pants, jogging pants. From now on, only dresses with pockets and leggings and dance go tennis shoes. Give away the other 25 pairs of shoes, all of them. Shoulders down. Enter the empty home, free of comments, observations. Report cards come out tomorrow, Friday. Let's wait until Saturday or Sunday to look up the grades. Let's go to the beach first, to the skateboard park, to the women's self-defense class, to Assateague Beach, and check on the horses again.
The voice of Sunu Chandy. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, Natalie Canavor, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.